I was in the airport the other day in Houston, and this lady, I was changing planes, and this lady walks up next to me, and she just takes a few steps, and she just looks at me, and she says, "How tall are you?" And I keep walking. I say, "I'm 7'4". She ponders that for a moment. She says, "I hope you did something with that height." And I said, "I did." And we kept walking.
Oh, man.
That's cool, though. Yeah.
That's a beautiful piece of Americana.
Yeah.
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 Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls.
I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sell or Die. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer. You may know me as the author of The Little Red Book of Selling. And I'm joined today by the lovely, the talented, the amazing...
Jen Gluckhaus, founder and CEO of Sales in a New York Minute.
And we're about to talk to you today about some amazing happenings in the world of sales, but we have a guest today that is, I don't know, not only off the chart, but bumps his head on the on the door jamb when he walks into any door.
Yeah, he is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Person. Nice guy. Professional athlete, the great Mark Eaton, mm-hmm. who at 7'4" tall, played for the Utah Jazz for a little bit more than a decade, made the All-Star team, set some records, and has been a friend for a long time.
Yeah. Before we get into it, Jeffrey, I want to talk today about sales teams because sales managers often...
I don't
want
to talk about sales teams. You talk on your own.
All right, fine. See ya. Sales teams...
See, that's how sales teams are.
Yeah, but sales managers often refer to their sales force as my sales team.
Right.
They use the word team as if they're a team.
Well, they're trying to be nice and inclusive.
Well, they actually want to think, or they're trying to think that they're a team.
Right.
But salespeople don't think they're on a team most of the time.
Not only not think it, Jennifer, they don't want to be on the team. They want the guy next to him to die so they can have his leads or his book of business. And they go up to his boss and go, if Bob dies, can I have his book of business?
But here's the thing. If I'm selling something in New York City and you're selling something in Utah and we work for the same company and we don't have the same... territories, why shouldn't we be on a team?
Well, we can be on a sort of a team. We can come to a meeting and we can both give ideas about how we close the deal.
Because I can learn from you and you can learn from me.
Maybe, but if I'm the best sales guy on the team, I don't think I can learn from anybody. And New York people don't want to learn from other people. They just want to go out and make a sale.
Smart New York people want to learn.
Okay, name 100 of those. But but here's the deal. The salesperson... doesn't want to win one for the team. They want
to win one for themselves. And, right. and their customer and then the right. team.
So if you go watch a movie, you know, Win One for the Gipper, the Newt Rockne story, that's a movie. They're not going to win one for the Gipper. They're going to win one for themselves and their kids' tuition and their car payment and their mortgage payment. So if the manager understands that the salesperson wants to win for themselves, then maybe they can say, hey, if you want to win more, listen to what your fellow salespeople are saying. Maybe you can learn something from them and make more sales.
So this episode is all about the four commitments to a winning team from Mark.
Right.
And I just want to set the stage because a lot of salespeople, as we said, don't feel that they are on a team. I ran a sales team for a couple of years, and I believe one of the reasons we were so successful at exceeding our quota was that we did act like a team. And so let's talk about the benefits there are out there when you're a salesperson and you are part of a team and you contribute to the team.
Bob wants to win the sales contest so he can make the president's club, but Bob has to realize that he is on a team. And the sales manager has to say, hey, you're on a team. Everyone on the team has a different position. They're not all salespeople on the team, or it's not a real team, because there are people that ship the product. There are people that bill for the product. There are people that answer the phone. There are people that provide inside service.
So the company is a team.
The company's people on his or her team. There are specific people. There may be five people in accounting, but only Mary is assigned to Bob. So Bob has an internal team and maybe even an external team, somebody who delivers the stuff. And that's how they have to coordinate so that they make the best impression to the customer, make everything perfect. Somebody may have to be there when the product is delivered.
Yes, that's correct. But oftentimes in a company, salespeople are not competing against each other for the same sale. Maybe if you're like selling at Saks Fifth Avenue and a customer walks in and you don't have some sort of code between your employees, you're going to jump to get that customer. Okay. That's bait. You want to work with them.
Right.
Okay. Especially if they look like prejudge them
exactly.
And you think that you can sell them a lot of clothing. But if you work at a corporation where it's B2B, your team, if your manager is smart, has been divided up into specific territories. So let me go back to this. If I'm selling in New York and you're selling in Utah, I own the New York City territory. You own the Utah territory. We are not competing. Our competitors are those other guys down the block.
I totally agree.
And so what I wanted to talk about were the benefits of us working together on a team before we get into how to be a team.
No argument on that, Jennifer, but understand that they make up about a third of the sales teams. The car sales guy, as an example, wants the other guy not to come to work today so he can have more leads. There's no kumbaya on that team, but there's a service manager, there's a finance
100%
guy.
100% agree.
Okay, so there are vertical teams and there are horizontal teams.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know, the sales manager has to be smart enough to know when he or she can build a horizontal team.
Correct.
If there's no competition, perfecto mundo. The horizontal team can be built.
Correct.
If there is in-house competition, then it's very, very difficult to create any kind of kumbaya.
I would argue that most of the time, the B2B sales are horizontal, where you can have a team that you're working with that are not just the internal people supporting you, helping with leads, helping with follow-up proposals, that kind of thing, but also your teammates are the salespeople.
If there are specific territories.
B2C, right. B2C is more vertical, where you need the inside person and the other people within the company internally to be on your team.
Okay, so we're in agreement that there can be conflict, but what I wanted to ask you, Jen, is if you would share with our listeners how you made your team work. How did you create that team that worked in harmony?
It's not easy because even when they are not competing because they have different territories, mm-hmm. they're still competing for number one.
Right.
Salespeople are naturally competitive and want, like you mentioned, going to President's Club. They want to be in whatever form of President's Club you have at your company. They want to not just be in it, but be number one in it. Right. But I think that people are naturally, they're born with the desire, most people, to help others. And there is this desire that or what I have seen, you can bring it out of people. If someone is really good at something, let's say you are the closing expert and we are on
Okay. Yeah,
let's say, Jeffrey.
Okay, let's say that. Okay.
And we're on a team call. I'm going to talk you up and talk about why you're the closing expert, give specific examples of amazing deals that you've been able to close that, you know, were really hard closes, and then have you talk about how you did it.
Or why you're the king or the queen.
Yeah. And okay. So I'm going to give you the spotlight and then help have you educate the rest of the team on how you did it so that now they feel like, here's how he did it. This is real world. This is not just our manager telling us how to do it.
So what you're saying is that a salesperson can actually come on with an objection to a sale or a time lapse in a sale and then talk about how they overcame that or stuck with it. And the sale actually got made over an extended period of time, which can really reinforce the belief of all the other salespeople when they do it.
Yeah, and the key is for the manager to know exactly what's going on, the details of how their salespeople have been successful, so that when they're on a team call and someone says, well, here's where I'm stuck, the sales manager can say, hey, Joe, you had that same situation 3 weeks ago. Why don't you talk about what you did?
What I found in sales teams and what I found in sales forces is that they all have the same objections.
Mm-hmm.
There's only 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have the same ones. You know, the guy said the price was too high. The guy wouldn't return my call. The guy didn't take our proposal because he took the lowest price. I couldn't get in to see the decision maker. There's nothing new other than I lost it to a cheaper price to Amazon.com on the internet. That's going to be a new one that's going to be universal and people are going to have to deal with that. But when the salesperson feels that there's camaraderie through adversary, then they're more likely to join one another.
And here's the thing. They want to feel like they're part of a team, even if they hate the next guy. Even if they're competing against the next guy, they want to feel like someone else is going through the same thing that they're going through because they're all alone in their territory. You know, they're not going to an office every day seeing companions.
I agree with that.
They're, you know.
But the manager has to come in, the leader has to come in and go, guys, when you talk about this, no bitching.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, let's take the negativity out of it. Like, the company doesn't understand me. The boss is a jerk.
Yeah.
Well, the boss may be a jerk. But but you know what I'm saying. There has to be a sort of an understanding of language back and forth so that there can be a potential solution rather than two people talking at the water cooler about how bad things are.
100%. Water cooler conversations are not
usually
good. You know, so what Mark Eden's going to talk about is the good advice that's going to help if you want to be on your team, and advice that's going to help if you think your team sucks and you don't want to be on your team, because it's going to help you be a better team player no matter what.
The one thing you have to understand about Mark Eaton and this whole thing is, at his core, he's a nice guy.
Mm.
And he is a helpful guy. He is a friendly guy. He is a giving guy. And that helped him win for his team.
Yeah.
And he stuck with it. He was a loyal guy. And he made friends with, you know, he's still friends with all of his teammates. So you look at it from that perspective and think about your own qualities. So while you're thinking of, when you listen to this interview, don't simply listen to it with, oh, what's this guy going to tell me? Listen to it and compare it to what kind of a person you are. And could you execute this in the same way that he did? Because keep in mind, he was on a winning team. And he became an all-star by following his own creed and his own credo. And more importantly, you're going to find out, here's a 7-foot, 4-inch guy that didn't really start to play basketball in earnest till he was 21.
Mm-hmm.
Hated the game.
All right, let's take a listen.
There we go. The great Mark Eaton. So, Mark, welcome to Charlotte, North Carolina, where you will be giving a major presentation to a major Fortune 10 company tomorrow.
Thank you.
You'll be speaking to the people at Caterpillar.
Yep.
And you're going to be talking about what are you going to be talking about, Mark?
A little bit about teamwork and staying safe out there, because it's obviously they're a company that has a lot of safety concerns as well.
Of course.
So, but we're going to talk primarily about the four commitments of a winning team and kind of getting rid of that internal competition at work and how to make each other look good and how to trust each other a little bit more and hopefully improve the camaraderie and the culture of the organization.
What are the four commitments of a winning team?
Oh,
well,
that's a secret, isn't it?
I want to know.
No, it's not. It's not a secret.
Oh,
it's on the inside flap of the book, I think.
Got it.
For those who just want to read that part.
Wait a minute. You mean this book here, the one that's coming out in April?
Yes. Yep.
The four commitments.
Yep.
Of four commitments
of a winning team.
That you can buy right now on Amazon if you pre-order it.
Correct.
Okay.
Or Barnes and Noble. Yes.
Okay. Cool.
So the commitments are really couched in my story of coming from a 21-year-old auto mechanic who couldn't play basketball to an NBA All-Star. Mm-hmm. And along the way, I met people, coaches who pulled me aside and shared things with me that I share in the book that helped me kind of get my career launched and then get to the next level. So the first one of the stories is an encounter I had with Wilt Chamberlain at the men's gym at UCLA one afternoon. I wasn't playing much at UCLA. In fact, I didn't play a whole lot there during my couple years there. But I was in the men's gym one day and kind of struggling, trying to catch a lot of the faster, smaller players. And Wilt Chamberlain grabbed me and said, you know, quit doing that. Like, don't chase these little guys up and down the court. You're 7'4". Come with me. And he parked my butt underneath the basket. And he said, look, your job is to stop players from getting to this basket. Your job is to make them miss their shot and collect a rebound and throw it up to the guard, let them go down there and score it, you know, and then your job is to kind of cruise up to half court and see what's going on. And that was a life-changing moment for me where I started to understand how to focus more in on my role and the thing that I did well. And so I call that point knowing your job. You know, what's that one thing you're excellent at that you could leverage more? And I walk people through an exercise of how to kind of focus in on it, because we live in such a busy world. We have so much stuff coming at us. Like, what's that one thing that you do well? What's that one reason that people buy from you or do business with you?
However, let's talk about it. You were able to take the coaching.
Yeah.
And you were able to discern from that what the message was that was being given to you by arguably the greatest basketball player of all time. People will argue it's Michael Jordan, but Michael Jordan didn't average 50 points a game for a season. Michael Jordan never pulled down 55 rebounds in a game.
Nor did they change the rules because of exactly. Michael Jordan's impact.
They widened the foul lane for Wilt. Yeah.
Wilt would always say that, you know, when they talk about Kareem being the greatest player or Michael Jordan, he'd always say, unless they change the rules of the game because of your impact, I don't know if I would say I'm the greatest of all time.
Yeah. And, you can argue the point, back and forth, but the bottom line is that you took the coaching and did something with it. Most people will go, yeah, 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 and give it two thoughts, but not a third thought.
And still think they know everything.
Right. You actually molded your career around it.
Yeah. And yeah, there's probably sometimes I probably listen to too many people, but I was always interested on how to do it better and how could I do it more efficiently. And I wanted to succeed. I wanted to get better. And it was only through the experiences of others and learning what they had learned in their life or in their careers that got me to that next level. And I was always grateful that somebody was willing to come alongside of me and say, mm-hmm. hey, Mark, have you ever thought about doing it this way?
And so what's number two?
So number two is about execution. It's about doing what you've been asked to do. So are you really clear about what other people want from you? And when I was at UCLA, I wasn't playing very much, and I called my junior college coach who had convinced me to leave my toolbox behind and try basketball again. And he was always there for me and still is today. And he said, I was all frustrated that I wasn't playing. He said, well, that's great. If you're not going to play in the games, then you need to start making your practices your games, because the problem is not the coach. It's not the team. It's you. You know, you need to get better. And so he said, if you're not going to play in the games, you got to make you got to be the first guy to practice and the last to leave and do your running and do your shooting. Because he said, we're playing for the long term here. This isn't about whether you're playing or not this year in college. This is about what you're going potentially do when you leave college, you know, whether you're playing overseas, you're playing in the NBA, whatever it is. So you have to keep getting ready now for that. And so I make the point that in business, so many times we think we just did our best. And I was willing to go and talk to my coach and ask him, what do I need to do differently? And so that's what I ask people when I speak to them. You know, what do you need to do differently? Do you really know what other people want from you? Do you even take the time to ask them? Or are you just assuming that you're running along, providing the right product or the right service or doing the right job without that knowledge?
And do you have the right coach who will say the harsh reality like yours did? This is what you need to do differently.
I don't even know if it's harsh reality. I think sometimes we just assume we're doing these things. Like, you know, it's that same thing. Like they talk about, Ken Blanchard used to talk about in that book, Raving Fans, about you go from hiring people to judging them without the coaching piece in between. Mm-hmm. And so then people get hardened in that way. Is like, well, geez, I don't really know how to do my job. And I really don't want to go ask them because I fear I'll get yelled at.
Yeah, but so, that coach did not give you advice. He gave you vision. Yeah. And he was willing to challenge you to take the long-term look. Instead of you whining about you're not playing right now, he said, don't worry about right now. Worry about the next 10 years.
Right. And let's get ready for that opportunity that's going to come down the road. I think we've lost a lot of that in our society today. I think it's always about what's here, what's happening right now, and who's tweeting about that or talking about that. And I'm sure you see it in the world of sales.
It's like
no one knows how to really develop relationships or think about why do you do business with people. It's not because I've got the wildest whiz-bang thing. It's really because there's a relationship established there.
There's also about the pressure of having to make your number, your quota every month, and there's an intensity about that.
Right.
That doesn't really have time often to look at the big picture. I don't want to see about next week. I just want to see about Friday.
Right.
And, you were given the blessing of somebody telling you to look down the road for 10 years and just go out and play every day, no matter what it is, and pretend like the practice is the real game. That's huge advice.
Well, it is. And I think that regardless of what career you're in, there are those fundamentals that you need to execute every day that make the biggest difference, that transcend the pressure of Friday or this month or this quarter or whatever it is. And I think to your point, that's right. That was important for me. So that was number two.
So what's number three?
Yeah.
So number three is about making other people look good. And I tell the story of coming to the Utah Jazz in the early 80s when they were a bad team in a bad market, losing money, losing games. And our coach, Frank Layden, at that time, who was also the GM, saying, look, if you guys will just stop competing with each other and start cooperating with each other a little bit, the individual accolades will show up. And back then, you know, if you signed a contract with the team and, you know, it was all based on, well, what your scoring average is, as how much money you made based on comparing it to other players in the league. And he said, look, no one cares if you're scoring a lot of points on a losing team, right? Everybody wants the players from a winning team. Mm-hmm. And so he got us to start trusting each other a little bit more, cooperating with each other a little bit more. And the more we made each other look good, the better the team looked. And in time, the individual accolades mm-hmm. showed up. So perfect example is the second year I was in the league, we went from a losing team in the cellar to making the playoffs for the first time, winning a division for the first time, and we had four individual statistical leaders in the NBA, which has never been done since. So we had one player that led the league in scoring, Adrian Dantley, player that led the NBA in three-point shooting, Daryl Griffith, player that led the NBA in steals, Ricky Green, and a player that led the NBA in block shots, Mark Eaton.
Cool.
So the team won, we won.
That's amazing.
So that's making each other, make people look good.
And I'm sure that you having a vision over the top of everybody else's head in the game played a role as well, because someone could give you the ball and you could see what other people could not see.
Well, one of the things we did was, we predicated our offense on playing great defense first and running an opportunity. And so my job was to collect the rebound off the glass and then fire it out at half court to Ricky Green or to John Stockton and let them run down the court with it. That was the easiest way to score.
Mm-hmm.
I think I correlate it to like, what's the shortest distance between you and a check?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It's like the easy score was a fast break. Like, who wants to take the ball out of the basket, walk it up the floor, and try and grind out an offense?
Right. Yeah,
if I can get it
and
out
call
quick.
Number three or, you know.
Yeah, if I can get it out quick and get it to my guard, and he can throw it to a streaking Karl Malone at the other end of the floor, slam boom. Dunk, boom, that's 2 points. Next.
Yeah, exactly. Now we're at the big number four.
So point number four is what I did well on the basketball court was I protected my teammates. And so point number four is called protect others. And I asked the question, you know, who are you protecting at work and who's protecting you? And do you really feel safe at work? And some people say, well, you know, my boss doesn't make me feel safe. Well, it starts with you. Do you make the people around you feel safe? And the key to trust and the key to loyalty from your teammates and from your customers is that knowledge that you really have their back. You know, that you're really there protecting them. And so I actually ask in my presentation, I say, you know, take 5 seconds right now the names of three people you need to let know that you have their back this week. That's something that really I think gets missed. It's like we get the sale, we move on, right? We're done, we're out of there. You know, that's the end of that relationship. And who we do business with over the long time are those people that we do trust. And that's where that loyalty comes from. And I see that even in businesses that are highly commoditized, where there's 1,000 vendors out there and you can just price shop all day long. Who do you choose to do business with?
Well, it's probably
somebody
you
developed a relationship with and somebody who feels like they've got your back. So how can I make that person look good in their organization? How can I let them know that I'm there for them? What do you need? How can I help you?
I'm not going to buy price if I can't know that the product is going to be delivered. Mm-hmm. It's more important for me to keep a crew working than it is for me to save a dime.
Right, right. So how do you count on that delivery? It's because you trust that person. Mm-hmm. They're actually going to deliver if you give them the business. So I want to be that person.
So you've taken an improbable basketball career, literally. I mean, most guys who are 21 years old have already been playing basketball for 15 years
Correct.
Or more.
Right.
They have 15 years of dribbling under their belt.
Correct.
Correct?
What was it
Correct.
Like to start later?
It was a challenge. Number one, I didn't like basketball, and being 7'4", what's the one question everybody asks you, right?
How's the weather up there?
Well, that or do you play basketball?
Yeah.
And I didn't have a good experience in high school. I sat on the bench. I didn't like it. It was not fun. And I grew up in a kind of a blue-collar household. My father was an educator at a junior college and also a diesel mechanic, primarily working on boats, marine diesel. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in that kind of environment, helping him fix boats on the weekends and things like that. And so I went to trade school because I was like, I don't know what I want to do. Basketball is definitely not in the picture. Mm-hmm. And I became this auto mechanic, and I was working at a tire and auto store in Southern California when this junior college coach pulled in and convinced me to give it another shot. And it was challenging because I had been, you know, eating junk food and hadn't done really anything athletic for a long time. So the first few weeks were pretty darn rough. But I liked what he had to say because he had worked with a couple other big guys, a guy named Sven Nader, who played behind Bill Walton, and had helped him. And so he understood the game from a big man's perspective, which was different than your standard high school coach would know.
A lot of young big guys have the walking chewing gum problem.
Yes,
where you can walk, but not at the same time you're chewing gum
because there's a coordination problem. They develop later. They're growing so fast that the muscles and the coordination just doesn't catch up until they're 19 or 20 or 21. And in my case, never.
But I went to Haddonfield High School. We had a kid named Ed Sweeney, mm-hmm. who was 6'10" as a sophomore, and it was going to be like our golden year with one exception, and that is he couldn't dribble and he couldn't shoot. And the coaches, I would go to basketball practice after school just to watch this guy.
Right.
And the coaches were so frustrated with him that they didn't know how to coach him. They didn't know what to do with him because he didn't have fundamental skills.
Right. And so those players get cast off aside because they're not
about the
here and now. And they're not willing to take the time to develop them, understanding that it's going to take some time. And so this junior college coach, that's what he did with me. And even when I came to the Jazz, Frank Layden looked at me and he said, and he was an old Staten Island high school coach and coached at Niagara, and he'd been around a while. He says, look, I want you to be comfortable with the basketball. I'm going to force you to do dribbling drills, force you to do ball handling drills. Not that I need you to bring the ball up the court, but he says it's going to increase your confidence with the ball on the basketball court. And he was right. I did the dribbling drills. I did the running drills, everything else he wanted, and I got more comfortable with the basketball, and it improved my confidence and improved my game.
Isn't it interesting that one of the most watched things in professional basketball right now is Steph Curry's pregame dribbling drills?
Correct. Yeah.
Thousands of people will show up early to watch this guy go through his dribbling drills.
Right.
Unlike any other player ever.
Yeah.
And geez, it's so amazing that he can dribble so well on the court. I wonder how that happens.
What's that?
Yeah. Yeah. And his daddy, I mean, he's got the lineage. You know what I mean? He's already got. He can already shoot. He was born a shooter. Yeah. Now all he has to do is become a ball handler to a point where you've seen him make some of the most unbelievable plays in the history of pro basketball.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. Anyway, so you're a dribbler now. I mean, you can bring the
I don't know about that, but I was always comfortable that if I had to take two or three dribbles to get out of traffic and create the outlet pass, that I was comfortable doing that, and it did increase my confidence with the ball when I got a rebound and had to clear some space or whatever it was to get rid of it, and I felt more comfortable and more complete as a basketball player because of that.
The most interesting thing is you had some pretty good players that you played with.
Yes,
I mean there were no slackers on the Utah Jazz for a long time.
Right.
You won a lot of your nemesis obviously was the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, and no, they didn't ever win a championship. But we had 20 consecutive playoff appearances, and we went from a team that was losing money in a bad market and made it a perennial contender. And I think that's what I'm most proud of, and I think many of my teammates are most proud of. So whether it was starting out with Adrian Dantley and Daryl Griffith and Ricky Green, and then moving on to John Stockton, Karl Malone, Thurl Bailey, Bobby Hanson, guys like that mm-hmm. became a part of the team going forward.
20 consecutive playoff appearances?
20 consecutive playoff appearances,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you certainly were always in the hunt.
Yeah. and we were always in the mix, and we were respected. And you know, and our coach would tell us, "Hey, look, if you know, if we're gonna not going to make the playoffs, we're going to affect the playoffs. We're going to beat the Pistons and the Lakers and the Celtics and some of these things." And Frank would tell us that kind of stuff. We'd look at him like we were crazy, and he'd say, "I'd rather lose the game by 2 points instead of three." You know, that first year we had a losing season. We're like, "Well, why?" Because 2 points is closer to winning. You know,
exactly.
He would do things like that.
And what was the difference when you went from Frank to Jerry Sloan?
Yeah. Well, Frank had an interesting challenge because he became sort of the face of the team, because we were in my rookie year, there were only 17 televised games, most of our games, and those games were shown on tape delay at 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
In Salt Lake City, Utah.
So nine people were watching.
Right.
Because they all drink milk and cookies and they're in bed
by
7.
And they go to bed, right, exactly. So no one really knew who we were. And Frank took on this personality of being this fun-loving, funny guy, because he was a great joke teller, a great stand-up lunchtime speaker. And so once he got the team to a certain level where we were competitive, then Coach Sloan came in, Jerry did, and really took that intensity to another level. He said, "Okay, you guys do this well, you do that well. We're going to focus more on execution now. We're going to focus more on proper defense and getting through screens and really not cutting any corners," and turned up the heat. But he was also very consistent about it. You knew exactly what he expected every day. Where Frank was a little more emotional, up and down and kind of all over the map sometimes, Jerry was just the same way every day. He expected that performance, that intensity. And there's certain things in basketball court that you can do every day regardless of whether the shot's going in or not, right? You can play defense. You can get yourself prepared. You can get rebounds. You can get a steal. You can get your hand on the ball, whatever it is. And that's what Jerry Sloan expected. And I think that's what took the team to the point where they were able to go to the finals a couple years in a row.
I think that if you're a salesperson right now and you're listening to this and you go, "Okay, it's a basketball talk." No, Mark is talking about preparing. He's talking about consistency, and he's talking about intensity. And if you don't have those three pieces as a firm part of your repertoire when you're out on a sales call, you're going to die. That's why this show is called Sell or Die, because you either make the sale by selling yourself and then your product or service, or you die because your preparation sucked, your consistency sucked, and your commitment sucked.
Mm-hmm.
And either one of those, if you lose either one of those three things, you're going to die.
So let's say you did lose a game, which is like losing a sale.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do to pump yourself up for the next game?
Well, I think we always looked at it as the long-term play that, you never got too high after a win. You never got too low after a loss, because there's another game tomorrow. There's three more this week. And if you started dragging around that kind of negative energy from the game we lost last Wednesday, mm-hmm. you're not going to be 100% available for the possibility today of winning this game or winning that next sale. And so much like golfers, when they talk about they have a bad hole, and the golf psychologist, the sports psychologist will say, "Okay, you leave that hole behind and you get on the next tee box, it's a brand new game." And so I think that's what carried us is letting go of whatever happened, good or bad, and being completely present and focused on what the opportunity is right now.
So let's go out into the street. We have been friends for a pretty decent amount of time. At least I've been friends with you.
We have.
Yeah. And we belong to this group called the National Speakers Association, which is a highly evolved, egotistical group of 4,000 people, of which 200 make all the money. But when you go to their annual convention, they have two separate rooms, one for the speakers and one for their egos. But the bottom line is that when you find the people that you can relate to, you become friends with them, really good friends with them. And you're a person who is – no one has ever said, "Hey, have you seen Mark Eaton? I can't find him." You're easily –
If I'm there, you know it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's right.
So how do you handle your height in a social situation when people are sort of gawkers?
Well, I will tell you, it is a challenge at times. But I think what I've done in terms of looking at my speaking career, it's like, all right, I'm tall. You got to accept that. What else can we do with it? Mm-hmm. And so whether it's, you know, knowing that at the end of the speech, people are going to want to take pictures and saying, well, why don't you pick up a book while you're here? To saying, well, why are you going to hire me versus somebody else that they're looking at? Mm-hmm. That's a unique advantage that I have. And so I've tried to, and it's taken me a long time in my life to be able to get okay with that, to use that as an advantage, because it's always been something that's been, like I said, it's been very challenging at times.
Hello, 7'4".
Yeah, and it's still, you know, I you get a standing ovation, you walk off stage, and everybody's like, yeah, and then you go to the airport, you know, and the first person's like, hey, how tall are you, dude?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. Yeah.
So you have that reality to deal with, but I think for the most part, I've done a good job of you know, trying to make it an asset.
Well, first things first, we've both heard your talk.
Oh yeah, we did.
You're a 10.
Well, thank you.
It was phenomenal.
Your talk is informative and inspirational.
And engaging.
Yeah, totally.
So can you write that down?
Yeah. Well, you'll have this podcast.
Actually, it'll
can I put
be
that on the back
it'll,
of the book right here? Oh, it already is. Okay,
yeah.
Good. Yeah.
And I think that when you have that as your base, your foundation, then you don't have to worry about any of that kind of crap. And somebody says, hey, how tall are you? You go, 5'9", but I'm on stilts.
Yeah.
Well, you should wear a pin. That
that's
says
why
seven
we hang out,
four.
Because you'll tell them that, and they'll say, oh, that guy was really annoying, but I'm still a good guy, so it's
right.
Okay.
I am. Well, you're from Salt Lake. You're not allowed to be annoying.
Yeah.
It's
right,
like
yeah.
Part of the, you know, yeah. You're actually polite to everybody, which I, one of your, believe me, it's one of your weaknesses.
You got to work on that. Maybe that'll improve sales.
Jeffrey.
But I think the challenge for you is daily. Mm-hmm. And it's not something where you can all of a sudden wake up and walk around on your knees to be as tall as everybody else.
But do you have fun with it? Like, do you give out fun answers?
You know, to a degree. I mean, I make fun of it to a certain extent when I speak, but I also give people the reality of it. Of like, hey, you know, this is a challenge, but this is what I did with this challenge.
Yeah.
And I think that's relatable to people, because I think everybody in their life can look back and say, you know, geez, I get made fun of when I was in junior high or whatever it is. And so, you know, I try and level the playing field by bringing that up. But I don't know. Sometimes I have fun with it, but most of the time I don't. You know, I mean, people come up and they think they've got the newest, greatest, most creative one-liner that you've ever heard
how's
before.
How's the weather up there?
Yeah. And so I don't know. I have this friend of mine who, you know, Mark Mayfield, who's a comedian speaker. Yep. And he and I got together one day and he was like, you know, you should write a book about just the things that people say to you. And we were sitting in this bar in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and we'd both spoken at this conference. And we get up to go to the elevator, and I'm thinking, yeah, it's okay. That's a pretty good idea. And as I duck into the elevator, another guy in the elevator gets there and he goes, dude, I feel your pain. And Mayfield looks at me and it's like, see,
exactly.
You should write this
but
stuff
here,
down.
This is what I think. Somebody says, how tall are you?
Yeah.
And you can say, I'm so tall that when I sleep in a king size bed, I have to sleep catty corner.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I think you and I could get together on a book about that.
A couple of, so I'm going to give you,
could be a little,
this is how I sleep in a king size bed.
Right. You get a little 50 page book of questions and answers like that.
Right.
Like I was in the airport the other day in Houston, and this lady, I was changing planes, and this lady walks up next to me and she just takes a few steps and she just looks at me and she says, how tall are you? And I keep walking. I say, 7'4". She ponders that for a moment. She says, I hope you did something with that height. And I said, I did. And we kept walking.
Oh, man.
That's cool, though.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful piece of Americana.
Yeah.
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 But the challenge that you have is in your everyday life, you have to maintain an attitude and a sense of reality.
Right.
And you have to carry your attitude into your speech every time, because you have to be the best you can be in front of that audience, regardless of who said, you know, you know if it's raining before I do.
Right. Well, and that's the reality when you're a speaker, is every audience is a brand new group of people, mm-hmm. just like a sale, who don't know who you are, don't know what you do. Maybe they heard of you. Of course, I bring some NBA highlights. So that helps a little bit.
Right.
But
and they're good highlights, by the way.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they're going to be like, well, who are you? What are you going to say? And what could you possibly know about my life? And I think that's the attitude going in. And I think that, and I take that seriously. When I know that when I walk in a room, it's like, okay,
yeah,
it's my job to prove myself, but it's also to gain your trust during the conversation.
Calm the audience and be able to transfer your message.
Correct.
I'm going to tell you that he has as transferable a message as I have ever heard on a platform.
Wow.
And you have to look at it from the perspective of, if you get a chance, yeah, write that down. If you get a chance to see Mark Eaton speak, you should take it. Go to his YouTube channel. Take a look at some of the highlights. Go to his website, 7foot4.com.
Pre-order
his book.
Pre-order the book.
And
yes.
I don't want to make this like it's a commercial and I'm fawning all over Mark Eaton. I'm a speaker.
It sure sounds Jeffrey.
I've seen everybody. And when we walked out of the speech that you gave for the BNI group, it was phenomenal.
Thank you.
I mean, you've honed your skill. You've been doing it for a decade.
Right.
And you've honed your skill to a point where your talk is compelling.
Thank you.
And when you have that kind of a talk that can transfer that kind of a message, you're going to sell a hell of a lot of books.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that very much, Jeffrey.
We are now going to thank Mark Eaton for showing up. It's going to take him a long time to get out of the building. He has to duck everywhere. And we are going to wish him well for his talk tomorrow. We may show up for a little bit of it in the back of the room. I'm assuming there's going to be food.
Yes, there is.
Okay, yeah. Cool. So we'll show up for the food and the speech.
I'll notify the media.
Please. tell both your friends. Is anybody else going to be there? Are you bringing any troops with you?
Nope, just me. And cool. It's their annual sales awards and safety awards, I think, kind of meeting for their company. So I'm very excited to be a part of that. And we're gonna have some fun.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we will look forward to seeing you again on Sell or Die. Get a book or three. Go to Amazon.com. Get a book or three. Get them for your friends and your family. I can promise you that it will deliver a memorable and transferable message.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mark.
I appreciate that so much.
Mark Eaton rocks.
And he's a nice guy, and he can dunk.
You know, we should count the number of times you've said he's a nice guy.
Oh.
But on the show.
Well,
but
we've
the
been
truth
friends
is,
for a long
he
time.
He is a really nice guy. I 100% agree with you. And we keep saying that, and people who don't know him don't really understand, like, how nice he is.
Yeah.
And he's a smart guy.
There's a lot of athletes that are buttheads.
Yeah.
Better than asshole. And he exudes approachability.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've been friends for a long time. I'm very proud of that. And we have been communicators for a long time. Like, we'll text each other about one thing or another at odd times. And it always, you know, we help each other.
That's cool.
But I think the most important part is he's dynamic.
Yeah.
And when he makes a presentation, I would pay to watch him speak. That's how good he is.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And
he was really good when I saw him. Yeah, I agree. So, you know, a lot of people are thinking, like, at the beginning we were talking about teams that, you know, don't get along and compete, and people who don't want to be on a team with anyone else except the people that are really helping them at the back office.
Right.
And so if that's you, take the link for this episode and send the people on your team this episode and tell them, here's how we can work together.
Yeah.
Mark gives great advice for each player on the team, no matter what your role is.
If you're a sales guy or a saleswoman out there and you don't forward this to every single person that you know who's in a leadership position, even the CEO of your company, you're making a big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
Mark has a way of bringing people together and making them play together in harmony to be winners. And that's the objective in your company. And if you're listening to this and you have 1 ounce of inspiration from it, give it to somebody else. Let them be inspired as well. Even if you know other people on other sales teams, just do it.
Yeah. Mark's a record breaker, and he's going to help you
be a
record breaker.
He's a record holder.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that more important than that, he understands the game and how to play the game and how to win the game.
Yeah.
He doesn't win every game, but he's consistent enough to win more than his share.
So his book is coming out in April 3rd on Amazon. It's The Four Commitments of a Winning Team.
You're going
to
see it all over our stuff.
And you can actually pre-order it right now. You can add it to your cart. It's discounted on Amazon. You know, they play around with the price.
We know that well.
Actually, one of the cool things I learned about Amazon is if you buy something today and then like tomorrow you see it at a different price, all you need to do is email them and they refund you.
Oh, really?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Because I bought a book that was like $18 and then 3 days later it dropped to $14. I was like, dear Amazon, no problem. We refunded your account.
Wow.
I know. It's pretty cool. So his book is coming out April 3rd. It's called The Four Commitments of a Winning Team. And go pre-order it now.
We pre-ordered several copies, but for Mark, because we want ours autographed. But I'll bet you that if you look deep enough and find his address, which we're not going to give on this show, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere, maybe mail it to his office, he would sign it and send it back to you.
Oh, yeah.
In
a heartbeat. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So of course he would.
Yeah, exactly. We do the same thing here, by the way. People ask me all the time.
Yeah, people send books here all the time, and then we send them back.
Yep.
What
Postage
size?
Free.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
So there's a long pause.
Well, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about anything else that Mark said. That's what I was really thinking. Any of the commitments that may have stood out.
Yeah. To me, the biggest one is to know your job.
Mm-hmm.
Know how do you fit on the team, and what are the expectations of you as a performer? And it's so interesting that Mark Eaton was taught by Wilt Chamberlain.
I know.
So it's not something where he just like, well, I picked this up on it. No. He picked it up from Wilt frickin' Chamberlain.
But what a cool strategy from Wilt to say, look, your job is not to go running back and forth across the court. Your role is to stand right here.
And get balls.
Right. And by Mark knowing his role and those other guys knowing their role on the team, and I'm not really a sports fanatic, so I don't know everyone's name that he mentioned.
Yeah.
But, you know, by each of those guys, they were able to hold records all while being on the team. That's pretty freaking cool.
So before you criticize other people about how they're doing their job, why don't you think about how you're doing your job? And are you a 10 at your job or a 10.5 at your job, so that no matter what you criticize, somebody's going to say, he is our best guy, so I guess maybe he's accurate in that.
Yeah, and Mark talked about what can you do better.
Yeah. So you have to look at this from the perspective of it's about you being a member of the team and then playing as a teammate.
Even if you hate your freaking team.
So look at it that way. Have a wonderful time on your team. Maybe you'll take a little bit of a different perspective back with you. But I want to make certain that you do it with Death Wish Coffee.
Before we get to Death Wish Coffee, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jeffrey,
yes,
but
you
I'm
did.
Going to.
Okay, good.
We have the most phenomenal mugs on the planet, and they just arrived. Everyone on the planet can go get their new Sell or Die mug. They say there's no prize in second place in sales. There's no prize for second place in sales. Sell or Die podcast, and on the other side, they say, I'm a diehard.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty freaking cool. They're black with a red rim. I really like them.
They'll hold coffees or pencils.
Yeah, or paper clips or tea, whatever you
want. Or money.
If
you want to stand on the corner and beg. There's plenty of room for dollars in there.
Well, hopefully you're making enough sales that you don't need to beg. Anyway, you can go to buygetemer.com and under all products, scroll to the very bottom and you will see the mugs.
Uh-huh.
We'll also put the link in the show notes directly to the product. But right now, the first 50 mug buyers are getting a second mug free. So if you buy one mug, you get one mug free. If you buy 10 mugs, you get 10 mugs free.
But the mugs are cool. We're drinking Death Wish Coffee out of them right now. Death Wish Coffee, the strongest coffee on the planet. It will keep you awake for days. And we drink it because they're our sponsor.
And they're really good. Well, no, they are our sponsor. But if the coffee wasn't good, we wouldn't drink it.
No, we drank it way before they became a sponsor.
Right. We wanted them.
Exactly.
And we have their stickers plastered everywhere. Yeah, it's like a daily reminder to have
more
coffee.
We are a Death Wish home, not simply a Death Wish drinker. So get out there and get your Death Wish. But more important, I think you should look at the lesson you've learned today. Subscribe to us, share us. We're on every form of podcast, broadcast on the planet. Go to Gittimer.com. Go to the Gittimer Learning Academy.com. Take a look at what we offer for a long term. maybe get a mug or two, but be the best you can be for yourself. Be the best player you can be for yourself, and then you can be the best you can be for others. That's the real leadership tip of the day. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer.
And I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm reminding you to get out there and sell something, even if your ass falls off.